And we'll kick it over to Alan to lead us through tonight's deck. I'm going to mute all, and you will have the ability to unmute yourself. So, Alan, you will have to unmute. You're unmuted, okay. So, everybody just remember that if you want to jump in for any comments or questions or anything like that, by all means, unmute yourself, and we do ask that you remute yourself once you're done so we don't get too much background noise. Alan, take it away.
Okay. Welcome to Q&A, everyone who's left. Our first slide is asking for information, and Chris has some information on that.
Yeah, this was a query from a member, and thinking it might be a neat idea if we had some people chime in with just little bits of information about three topics in particular. So one was how you secure your computer, what software you use, what settings you use, are there behaviors that you really try to pay attention to in order to make sure that your computers remain safe, your information remains safe, your identity isn't compromised. Another topic would be programs you use. Are there some hidden gems of some programs that you use that you think maybe some other people aren't using and they could take advantage of? Doesn't have to be free software. Free software is great, but if you have commercial programs that you find particularly useful, you know, maybe you want to share that information with others. And then the third topic was computing habits you use. So this could be just about anything, you know, so best practices, what enhances your productivity on your computer, what makes sure that your computer is, you know, it's running smoothly, you know, it's up to snuff on all the things. Any sort of things like that that you think you might want to contribute to, by all means, if you think you can share something, throw it into the suggestion box at opcug.ca, and we'll set aside a little bit of time. You could either do it as a demo, a slideshow, or just an audio discussion of something. That's what we're here for, is so that we can all share.
Okay, so I hope everybody bears that in mind. I can think of a program that maybe not everybody uses. Anyway, let's see what happens. And the second thing we have is a follow-up on saving disk space, and Chris has a wild example for us.
Yeah, this is really cool. So last week we had the ultimate guide to saving disk space, and then I ran into it by somebody I know. I won't name names or anything like that, contacted me about the fact that they had a 250 gig solid-state drive on their laptop computer, and it was getting very low on space. And they happened to notice that, you know, it shouldn't really be losing that much space. Well, the first thing, and this should actually be added to the ultimate guide to saving disk space, is if you're in a position of you're trying to find files on your computer that you can get rid of, one of the important things is to show hidden files. If you're hunting out stuff, a lot of it is going to be in areas that are hidden. So you go to the File Explorer, the View tab, Show Hide section, and there's a checkbox for hidden items, and it will not be selected by default. Select it, and then all of a sudden you'll see all kinds of more stuff. Now, on this particular computer, we found a lot of space on old software. They had several old versions of photo editing software, about 3 gigabytes worth. And they only used the most recent version, so we uninstalled those. They had an old trial version of Adobe Premiere, which is their video editing software, which was using about 1 gigabyte. Well, it had gone past the 30-day trial or whatever anyway, so it wouldn't work even if you wanted it to. So I got rid of that. And then I fired up TreeSize Free. And TreeSize Free really makes it easy for you to ferret out where big stuff is on your computer. And I found quite quickly that the user profile was using 110 gigabytes. Now, on somebody who does a lot of photography or video editing or things like that, that might not be unusual. However, this person stored all their photos and their videos on an external hard drive. So they on the laptop's SSD, there was no photos or videos, things like that. So 110 gigabytes is pretty big for the user profile. We looked in under the temp directory, there was 10 gigabytes. So this person obviously hadn't cleaned out their temp directory in quite a while. So that freed up 10 gigabytes. And then we noticed that there was a 60 gigabyte dragon.log file under /users, their username, app data, which is a hidden directory, and then, you know, it was under, I think, roaming, and it was buried down underneath that. So not wanting to, wholesale just delete this file if it turned out that it would contain all of his training of Dragon Naturally Speaking, and it might go back to the way it shipped, and he, you know, have to train it all again, and so forth. He eventually contacted Dragon Naturally Speaking. They hummed and hawed a bunch about it, said, well, no, it's just about information about crashes and about operations that have gone on. So he deleted it. 60 gigabytes freed up. So overall, he freed up about 75 gigabytes worth of space off of that 250 gig solid state drive. So this ultimate guide to saving disk space, it works.
And I just echo the use of TreeSize 3. That is a really good program. And what Chris is doing there is looking at the folder structure, finding out where the biggest folder is, and then drilling down. And as you drill down, the subfolders also get listed by size. So you can very quickly find out what is hogging the disk space. It's a really, really good program.
Yeah. And 100% free. They don't nag you. Nice.
Yeah. Okay. The next thing we've got is a follow-up essentially from last week when somebody asked for kind of a tutorial or a Q&A session on file management, disk management. So I just threw a few. This is another one of, this is how I do it, not necessarily the best way of doing things. And again, if other people have different ideas, feel free to chime in, correct me, update me, provide different options, whatever you wish. This is just a few thoughts I have. And I've broken it up into two sections. So tonight we're just going to talk about file and folder management. And on my system, the first thing I'll tell you is where my files and folders aren't. And there's really two ways you can deal with files and folders on your computer. You can go the kind of Microsoft recommended route and use their system, which is essentially this series of documents and music and pictures and videos. And they kind of look as though they're folders, but they're really not folders in that sense. Like documents is not a documents folder on the root of the C drive. It's not C:/documents, which you would think it is. It's one of Chris's favorite hidden files, if you like. I mean, it's not actually hidden, but it's actually in the users folder, and then it's under your username, and then there's a folder called documents. So documents is really C:users/ your username/documents. My question is, why do you bother? Why do you make it so complicated when you could just use a simple folder on the root directory called documents? And basically that's my rant, if you like, about Microsoft.
I'll jump in with a quick comment on that, Alan, is that one of the reasons why they don't make it C:/documents is because they've designed it as a multi-user operating system. And so they do want to segregate separate documents folders for each user on the computer.
Okay. And you also made a note to me that you can actually change that location.
Yeah.
If you right-click on documents and choose properties, then you can change the location to something that would suit you better, I guess.
That's right.
Libraries can be are kind of special in that they appear on Explorer, File Explorer, as being more as one of the choices, and you can move any of those directories to other disks. I mean, I have all my libraries on my data disk, which I call Z, is the file letter, and because that's actually on a hard drive, while my operating system and programs are all on an SSD.
Yeah, that's as Alan mentioned, that you just right-click on your documents folder. You can go to properties, and there's a location tab. You can change it to whatever location you want.
Yeah, so it's not just documents. It's also videos.
Yeah. And pictures. Any of the libraries.
And the other particular libraries that show up when you open up File Explorer. So they're more visible and more easy to get to.
Yeah, I guess my problem is I use my computer as a single user system, so I don't care about multiple users.
Yeah.
And I also come from the DOS days when you did everything by yourself and you didn't have a babysitter. So my preference is basically I partition my hard drive. So drive C contains the operating system and all my installed applications, but all of my data files live on a dedicated data partition, which in the Windows world shows up as drive D after drive C. And then I use you can use a simple folder structure, so you can have a D colon documents and the spreadsheets and the pictures, and you can have subfolders, so the pictures would be broken up, say, by year. I actually break them up by country or travel trip or something like that. And so a separate data partition and a simple folder structure. However, of course, I don't actually do that. That's much too simple. I have a much more complicated system, but I like to think that I know what I'm doing. But essentially, I've got a whole bunch of folders, and I use the magic new folder icon at the top here. Just click on that. It creates a new folder, lets you give it a name, and then that folder becomes a regular folder on the drive. So as far as I'm concerned, I set up my own folders. So I have one called zero_archives, and I use the zero because that makes it come to the top of the list. And that contains subfolders which are going to get copied, archived essentially, to an external USB drive or two. So that's like a temporary holding area for files that I've developed but I really have no current use for. So I move them off my live data and put them into long-term storage. I've got a couple of folders which aren't really documents per se. They're actually mail folders. So Thunderbird, my mail client, lets me specify where I want the mail to be stored. So I tell it I'd like it to be stored on the data drive, the dedicated partition, because then it's always available to me for backup. And I also have a folder that I hide from my wife. I give it the secret name Alan. That's got most of my actual working folders in there. And again, there's lots and lots of folders in there. For example, there's one called GL Test, General Ledger. So this is a financial accounting system. But it's not really a document. It's essentially a spreadsheet. And it's a spreadsheet with a whole bunch of macro files, which are essentially programming code. And they're all in this one subdirectory where I can go play with them, and they're separate from anything else I'm doing. I've got a main folder called OPCUG, which is, of course, all the club stuff. So in there's a whole raft of folders and individual files. And for example, there's a subfolder called called articles. Well, clearly these are going to be word processing files, so they're documents in the Windows documents sense. But I have opted to store them in my Alan folder, in my OPCUG subfolder, and in an articles subfolder. So for me, that's the way I work. That's the way it makes perfect sense. I've got another folder called presentations, which are essentially PowerPoint decks. So for example, the deck that you're looking at right now is in this folder and is under development there from week to week. And then there's another folder called Q&A, where when the presentations are all done, and the audio file, the text file, the chat window file, the PowerPoint file gets converted to PDF, and then they get copied to the web server, essentially. So it's complicated. You might think it's chaotic, but it's my chaos. I understand it. And for me, that system works a lot better, and it's more efficient than using that Windows documents, music type folder system. So that's the way I do things. Okay, so moving along, I don't see anything that we haven't discussed there. Moving along, we have another share by Chris on control folder access.
Yeah, so control folder access is a new feature that was brought into Windows 10 with the Fall Creators Update, which was 1709 in 2017. And it was a really neat idea. I wrote about it in a newsletter article. I think it was early 2018 that I actually ended up writing about it. And the idea behind it is that it is designed to protect your data files against ransomware. Ransomware is, if you get it on your computer, it can encrypt all your files and then demand a heavy-duty payment for the decryption key to get your files back. Again, I often say on things like this, your best defense against this, quite frankly, is to have a good backup so that you can recover all your files from backup if you do get hit by it. But this is a means that they added to the operating system, and I took a look at it, and it has some interesting features to it. So what it's designed to do is only allow quote-unquote trusted programs to write to any of your protected folders or protected memory. And I don't understand about protected memory. I've tried researching it a little bit, and I don't quite understand that. So I concentrate on the protected folders. So the idea is that if you get malware on your computer, it won't be a trusted program, and it won't be able to write to any of the protected folders on your computer. So the default protection that you get with control folder access is you get a bunch of your libraries, which Alan has just advised you not to use. I shouldn't say that. He doesn't use. But there are protected folders, the public and personal versions of documents, pictures, videos, and music. So 8 folders there, plus your favorites, which is only under the personal. So there's a total of 9 protected folders that on your computer when you just turn it on. The trusted programs is a little bit trickier. Windows, or Microsoft, more accurately, I guess, has a list of trusted software. And they're not talking. So only Microsoft knows what's on that list. And I tried to find out, you know, a list of trusted software, and I couldn't find anything on it. So Microsoft is keeping mum about it, which bothers me a little bit. But for some people, this probably actually works quite well. So you can't remove any of the defaults. So if you turn on protected folder access, your documents, pictures, video, music, and favorites, they are going to be in that protected realm. You can't decide, oh, I don't want to bother protecting some part of it. But you can add to that. So you can add additional protected folders. So Alan, even though he's not using the library documents, he can protect D:\ documents if he so chooses. And if a program that you use is not considered to be a trusted program and you decide that it's trusted, you can actually add that as a trusted program. And so now we'll have a demo. So if the demo gods are good to us here, we'll get it and share my screen. Okay, so let me actually just get rid of a couple of things here. Okay, so if we look at here, we have a folder that I set up on drive Z called an attempt directory and a blocking directory. I have a couple of programs, and I have a text editor in here. And so if I go into this text editor and I save to that same location, okay, so I'm on Z, temp, blocking, and I'll give it that name, and I say save, and it saved the file, no problem at all. So I now have that file there. You get rid of that. Now what I'm going to do is I'm going to go into control folder access configuration. Now it's buried down a little bit, but quite frankly, the easiest thing is just go to settings and search on controlled, and you'll find control folder access. It'll load up Windows security, and it'll go down to the right spot on it, which is under ransomware protection. And all you have to do is turn it on. You get the user access control that pops up and says you really want to do this. And then this one, because I've got some antivirus exclusions, it wants to know, should I copy them to the control folder access? I'll just say no. And so now I'm into almost the default. So if I come into protected folders, I get the user access control again, and then I can see this list of folders. And there's my documents folder, the public documents folder, my pictures folder, public documents, public pictures folder, videos, music, and there's my favorites. Okay, so those are the defaults. If I click on it, you know, it says, oh, remove. I can click on that all I want. It'll disappear and it comes right back. So you can't delete any of those ones that are in there. I'm going to add a particular folder, and I'm going to add the Z temp blocking folder as a protected folder. So I'm going to go blocking, and then I'm going to say select that folder, and it is now in the list. That one I can delete. So anything that I add, I can also remove it. So now that it's in the protected folder, what I'm going to do is come back to here, and I'm going to go back to this text editor, and I will now save this. And now I get that it's kind of a weird error message, but in essence, this TED Notepad program has no clue what's going on. It tried to save it, and then it couldn't find the file. And it says file not found, check the file name and try again. I could try all day, and it's just not going to let me save that file to that folder because that's a protected folder, and this TED Notepad happens not to be on Microsoft's list of trusted programs. So how can we deal with that? So if we come back to our protected folders, and now if we come into allow an app through control folder access, I can now add an allowed app. So I have one app that I added on here that's Total Commander, that just as I was playing around, I didn't want it to be blocked ever. So if I do an add an allowed app, I can choose from recently blocked apps, or I can just browse for an app. So because this just got blocked, that's probably an easy way to go about doing it. There it is, tedmpad.exe in ztemp blocking tedmpad. So if I click on the plus, that program will now be allowed to write. So if I come to this and I do another save as and save, it has now saved that file to that location, and there's the file. Okay. Now, this one here, I don't know if this is going to work or not. I've had this really, really strange effect, Photo Sketcher, that sometimes it was allowed, sometimes it wasn't. So let's just see if it's going to get blocked this time or not. This is just a filter program that you can add filters to photographs. So I'm just going to say, okay, I'm going to open up a photo. And now I'm just going to add vintage photo as a filter that runs pretty quick. So I'll just add it. So it has now created this filtered view of it, and if I do a save, and I'm saving it to that location, so Z temp blocking, and it just adds this Photo Sketcher to it, and I click on save, and File not found. So it actually did get blocked. But the really weird thing about this is sometimes it gets blocked, sometimes it doesn't get blocked. I don't understand this. Okay, why sometimes PhotoSketcher is getting blocked. So again, on this one here, I could, so presumably under some circumstances it's considered to be a trusted program, but it doesn't seem to be consistent. So I'm going to come back to here and I'm going to do likewise on it where I will go to, I'm going to go to, where am I here? Okay. Oh, close. Okay. So I can do an allow an ad app again. I can go into PhotoSketcher and I can then go back to PhotoSketcher. Now that I've allowed it, if I click on save, it actually does save the file. And there is the photo that has been done. So there are some things that they've cleaned up in the program. Some of the complaints that I had about control folder access and the way it worked. It used to be that you could just name a trusted program to the same name as, or another program to the same name as a trusted program, and it was allowed to write to protected folders. That is no longer allowed. I don't know what mechanism they're doing to actually block or allow apps, whether it's doing it on a hash of the file. I really don't know. It does seem to work for the most part. If you're worried about ransomware, you might want to consider actually using control folder access and just realize that, you know, there are those things like all of the default folders are going to be protected by default. You may have a flurry of blocked programs on your computer that you will have to go in and say they are allowed to write to your protected folders. But overall, it does seem to work. Any questions on control folder access? Okay, I will stop the share.
Just Tom was mentioning that you can also use Configure Defender to protect control folders.
Oh, okay. Configure Defender, I bet it would actually let you take some of the default folders and decide you don't want them protected, which might be a kind of a neat thing.
Yeah, just before we move on then, on that section of file management, Corrine had said perhaps a how-to file is needed, and I asked her to clarify that. So can you do that, Corrine?
Hi, everybody. What I've found useful is you, in your folders, because you know, Alan, what's in each one, if, you know, something happens, somebody needs to go search for something for OPC, UG, or something like that, you can have within that folder, how do you use this? You call it a how-to file. You just call it how-to, and it gives instruction to anybody looking in there as to what is in there and how to use it.
Yeah, okay, good. I actually have
an example
of that coming up.
Yeah, okay, that's all I was suggesting is, it's just easier to go in there and then you know when it was created, how to use it, what is in there. That's all.
Okay. All right. Thanks, Green.
Welcome.
Okay. The last thing I'll say on control folder access before leaving it, I think I have an upcoming article for the newsletter that'll be an update to how it is now, how it's been updated since the first time I reported on the program, so on control folder access. So if you're interested in it more, play around with it or wait for my article to come out.
Yeah, Bob Walker here. Just a comment. Some of the security software, like Avast, has functionality similar to control folder access, and you have a bit more ability to customize it the way you want.
It's good that they include it because control folder access only works if you use Windows Defender as your primary antivirus on your computer. So that is kind of good that if you're using a replacement one, if they add in the similar functionality to it, that's great.
Yeah, Chris, just a little comment. When you were showing when you were doing the demo, the screen update is kind of slow, at least on my side, and was missing some of the screen that you were showing as you were updating them.
Oh, okay.
Just a little comment.
Yeah, okay. And next demos I give, I'll try and slow it down a little. Thanks.
Just a bit slow to update sometimes, that was all.
Okay.
Okay, so moving along to the actual questions we have in the pipe. The first one is from somebody who says their computer didn't update to standard time. How can I fix it? And Chris has the magic answer.
I actually ran into this on a couple of computers where, hours after the computer had started up on that day, I don't think I noticed it on any computer that was running when daylight saving changed to standard time. But on computers that were off, turning it on hours later, it was still out by an hour. And so really the simplest way to go about doing this is that you right-click on the clock area of the taskbar and then choose adjust date and time that pops up on the pop-up menu. And then you'll get the dialog box that you see over on the right-hand side. Now, the fourth one down is the one that you, or sorry, third one down is the one that you want to click on to just fix things immediately, and that's the sync now. And that will go out to time.windows.com, and that should fix the fact that it's out. While you're on that dialog box, you may as well check that all of the other settings are appropriate. So at the top, set time automatically. That's a good thing to have turned on. Set time zone automatically. I don't do it for desktop computers. I don't know exactly how they decide what time zone I'm in. So I actually just set the time zone and desktop computer. It's not going to change. On a laptop that you're traveling with, that might actually be more useful, because if you get off the plane in Vancouver and you hook up to YVR or hotspot in the airport, if you have that turned on, it'll change your time zone automatically for you. And so that can be a really cool way to get your computer onto the right local time. The next one down is the sync now, which I talked about. And then the other one that's important is set time zone. And so make sure that that is set to Eastern time. And then lastly, it's a good idea to actually have that on for adjust for daylight saving time automatically. So I recommend that you go in, make sure those are all set appropriately. And yeah, the sync now is the one thing that will get you automatically if you are out by that hour.
And just a note on that, I've actually had problems with the Windows time server sometimes not giving the right time. And Tom has got a note in the chat window on a couple of National Research Council time signal servers. So you can actually change the server that you go to, and if one isn't working, maybe another one will work correctly. Okay, I also have another interesting wrinkle with daylight savings time on my system, because as everybody probably knows, I run dual boot, so I'm running Linux Mint. And occasionally, like every Wednesday night, I have to run Windows 10 so we can run PowerPoint efficiently. And I have this dedicated data partition, which shows up as Drive D in Windows, but in Linux, it's called DataDisk. And one of the reasons I do that is because it makes it very easy to back up all my data. So I use Free File Sync to synchronize the data drive to an external USB drive. And normally when I run it, it looks a bit like the picture here where, you know, the latest files need to be updated onto the external USB. But on the day of the time change, every file on my hard drive gets listed as requiring being transferred. So typically I have 5, 6, 7 gigabytes of files that it thinks it wants to transfer over to the external USB because they're all an hour out. So it turns out that there's a much more efficient way of doing that, and that's just to change the time date stamp on the files. And I can do that very easily using a Linux bash command. It's essentially like PowerShell command or a DOS command line type command. And I use a combination. It's not mine. I found it on the web somewhere. But it basically uses a find command. So it finds all of the files on this this mount point here, if I can find my cursor, which is here. This mount point here, media/silicon 16 gigabyte. So that's my external hard drive. It looks for all types of files, and then it runs, it executes a utility called Touch. Touch is a Unix Linux utility which changes the time date stamp on the file. So actually quite a useful program. It's been ported to Windows, and I use it in Windows for the same purpose. But it basically touches all these files using the /r switches recursively. So it's doing them all files, all folders. And then it uses a D switch to use a specified date and time instead of the current date and time. Normally, if you just touch file name, it gives it the current date time. But I actually want to use it to change the date time setting by in the fall by subtracting an hour from the date time stamp. So basically, on the day of the time change, I basically copy this line of code, paste it into a Linux terminal window, and run it, and it basically updates all my files. So it's a really neat little way of doing it. Now, the other reason I wanted to show this is Corinne's example. And I could never remember that code string in my wildest dreams. Now, I could search for it on my Linux North blog because it's posted there, but I used one of Corinne's so-called how-to files. I call them help files. So I have this file called help.daylightsavings.txt. So when I load that file into the word processor, it tells me in the spring, then you need to add an hour, and in the fall, you need to subtract an hour, and it remembers the code, and I can just do the cut and paste. I find these help files really useful for a whole bunch of stuff. So I have a whole raft of them, and I tucked away on my hard drive. So when I need to do something that I can't remember how to do it, I just consult my help file, and it gives me the step-by-step instructions. So it's quite a useful technique.
Tom had a question about whether Windows is using UTC, and I believe it is. It uses UTC. And then he said, can you use UTC on Linux, which would get you around the problem of the timestamp being different?
Yeah, you can change that. There's a command in Linux to do that. The trouble is it doesn't seem to work with the external drive. The external drive sits there thinking it's an hour out all the time.
Ah.
I mean, the easy way is just to copy all the files over, but I find it's quicker just to change the time date stamp.
Yeah. And okay, I think so, it's a good example that you had of using a bash script there too. So, cool.
So the next question is from somebody who's using a laptop and the power icon disappeared from the taskbar, and he wants to know how to get it back. And Chris...
As it turns out, he did a reboot and it came back on by itself. But if you have it that it's not showing up, if you go to Settings, Personalization, Taskbar, Turn System Icons On or Off, there is an option in there for power. And if it is toggled off, then you just toggle that on, and then you will get that icon back at the bottom of your taskbar.
Okay, and then the next question is from Chris.
That's from me. This is really a weird one. Linda came across this as she was trying to get to Rotten Tomatoes, and she was using Chrome, and the homepage for Rotten Tomatoes popped up, and then it immediately flashed over to, we're sorry, but your browser isn't supported. and use a newer browser like Google Chrome or Mozilla Firefox. And she was using an up-to-date version of Chrome. And she tried Edge and got the same thing. But it worked fine with Firefox. Well, when I got home, I tried and I got the same problem with Chrome. Edge worked for me and Firefox didn't. And so I don't understand this at all, how Rotten Tomatoes is throwing up this error message saying that the browser isn't up to date. So I'm wondering if anybody has a clue as to why when you're using an up-to-date browser, you would get a message like this saying your browser isn't supported. So is there anybody who knows more about the web than I do? I know how to spell it, and that's about all. And so if anybody has a clue. Sorry?
Sure, it's bad luck.
Bad luck. Yeah, okay. I wish I had a better answer than that, Tom. And in particular, an answer that would make it work.
I just checked. It works on my Chrome. You could try updating Chrome. It's changed a couple of times in the last few days. So
yeah, but this was up to date. You go to help.
Do it again.
Going to help about, and it said it was up to date. And I can't believe that Rotten Tomatoes would bar a browser that was even 6 months out of date. Quite frankly. I mean, I don't understand why they would block it unless it's functionality that doesn't work with something that they built into their website. Well, they're not going to build a website that requires people to have today's build of Chrome, surely. And the fact that it didn't work with Chrome or Edge, but worked with Firefox, and for me, it didn't work with Chrome or Firefox and worked with Edge. It's just bizarre.
It works with Chrome. It works with Edge for me.
Okay.
Yeah, Chris, I just tried both and it works for me.
Well, let me actually try right now and just see if maybe it's something that was on their website. So
wasn't there something about
Flash? Just a second here. Rotten Tomatoes. Okay. Chrome worked for me. So who knows? Maybe it was something on their website that they fixed.
And it works on Brave as well.
Okay. Well, good to know that it's working.
Then we have to find out if it's working for Linda. That's more important.
Yeah, I think that's a more important one. But the fact that it...
It worked on Vivaldi.
Oh, actually, I just got it on Chrome. So it was working on Edge, but if I went to RottenTomatoes.com, and the homepage flashed up, and then it redirects me to RottenTomatoes.com /unsupported-browser?error=fetch. I have no clue about why this is happening. I mean, if people want to see it, I can share. If you don't believe me. But I don't know. Does anybody know what would cause something like that to occur? I don't think it's cached information because I regularly empty my cache.
Check your version number.
Well,
in the Chrome.
Yep.
I got 86.0.424.193.
That's what I'm on as well.
64-bit.
Yep. That's what I'm on. Oh, actually, this is interesting. I got it said, nearly up to date. So I'll relaunch.
Oh, yeah, I got that too.
Yeah, this is weird. So I'm now on 4240.198. And let's see if that works.
If I could interject, I just tried it on a Chromebox that I have beside my Windows PC. this is a Chrome box that hasn't been supported by Chrome OS for over a year, and it popped up just fine.
That's just too bizarre. Too bizarre.
But you know, sometimes they're doing tinkering with the programming for a website, and just I think there's something too about Flash being completely
removed. I wonder if it is Flash related or something like that.
I don't think so. I think it's there's been several recent exploits on Chrome and other Chromium type browsers. It's kind of mentioned in Security Now podcast and VRC.com website under Security Now. So check it. I just think it's they're trying to update it as soon as possible, and they may be blocking some things in the meantime. I think it's just a temporary phenomenon.
But interestingly, Edge Chromium, I can get to Rotten Tomatoes no problem.
Edge, I had to update Edge. It just updated today. So that's another thing.
Yeah, very strange. Anyhow, okay, I don't think that it's anything that I can fix. So I'll monitor for a while. Maybe next week I'll be able to report if I if the problem has gone away for me. I tried Googling about it, and I didn't find anything specific to Rotten Tomatoes. So.
Oh, by the way, regarding last week, Corrine was wondering why would you have use two different directories for different data sets. I see she's on now. One reason to have, for hard links, to have a file in two different directories is if you have several clients and you have an agreement between them, then you would want to probably have a copy of the agreement in both directories. And that would be a reason why you would use a hard linked file.
I like that reason. And that way you ensure by having it hard linked, you ensure that it's just one source, really. It's the one document. You're not going to end up with different versions somehow in the two different locations. Yeah, that's a good idea. So you could use permissions on things or whatever to limit access and whatever. Yeah, it's a good idea.
Okay, we're at that time where open forum. Does anybody have any other questions?
Regarding
one note that may affect some people is that apparently the plugin in Calibre that removes DRM is only works if you stay at Calibre version 4.3. So if you have any EPUBs that you want to access, the newest Calibre will not be able to DRM them. You need to go back to Calibre 4.3.
Oh God.
Justin, you had a comment?
Well, just something about Chris. Something I found is about some shadow DOM. And I'm not too sure what that thing is, but it says the shadow DOM allows hidden DOM trees to be attached to elements in the regular DOM tree. That's above my head. I have no idea what that means.
You and me both.
A DOM tree. A DOM tree is the I forget what it stands for, but it's the directory of stuff that's in your that's in the web page that you're accessing. So the DOM tree is a tree of everything that's in the current web page. It is a tree because you get loaded successively by as you go down and load things up. So that's what a DOM tree is.
So again, that's something that I wouldn't have any control over.
Not unless you wrote the web page.
Yeah. Hmm. Oh, well, I'm glad that I don't need to go to Rotten Tomatoes, but I do have at least one browser that works on Rotten Tomatoes, and Linda has at least one browser, different one, that works with Rotten Tomatoes right now. So we can always work around the problem, I guess, on that. I was just curious. Okay, do we have anything else for tonight?
Oh, by the way, that's the document object model, and it's in Wikipedia. I'll send a link on the chat.
Okay, got it. So that'll be in the chat transcript that'll be on the website.
And Bob's presentation, he talked about the computer Colossus. Well, at the end of the presentation, the movie Colossus, the Forbin Project, popped into my mind from 1970 that took over the world.
Yes, I saw that movie. Colossus and the Russian one, which whose name I forget.
Oh, yeah, that was in the sequel.
No, I think that was in the original in the Forbin Project. Colossus was the American AI, and I forget what the name of the other one was.
Maybe a question for Bob. I don't know if it's he's still around, but I was
he's
just
online.
Okay, I was just curious about the why it seems that the British were not able to use their computer knowledge from the Second War to good benefit, where the American did. Does he have any idea why the American were able to advance so much in computer where the British were not?
Yeah. One of the problems is the people that worked at Bletchley Park, like Tommy Flowers and that, that worked on these computers, after the war were forbidden from doing any real work on this because they signed the Official Secrets Act, and they couldn't leverage any of this knowledge practically. And whereas the Americans didn't have that limitation, and they were, you know, the American computer industry was able to hit the ground running after the war, and they had a few computers that were under development during the war that didn't get into operation during the war, but gave them a heads up right after as well. And so the British basically shot themselves in the foot. There were some important developments in Britain in the 1950s with computers, but they were operating with one hand tied behind their back. Whereas the Americans had their running shoes on. So.
Yeah. Well, thank you again for your presentation. It was very instructive. So thank you again.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay. I think we will call it a night then. And so thanks very much for everybody. Alan is going to finish up with his couple of slides.
Yeah, the usual slide. The next major presentation is from Lawrence on scam avoidance and trust. That's one of the library's Tech Cafe sessions on the 23rd of this month. And remember, if you want to attend that, you have to register because the library sends out the login credentials for the web session. So you need to register at that URL, or through that URL. And then the final thing before Chris wraps up, our next Q&A, of course, will be next week, and the suggestion box is open. So thanks, everyone, for attending tonight.
Tom commented that the library has been closed. They've reopened, apparently. They had an emergency yesterday that they're pretty tight-lipped about. He says it's not open today. My understanding was that they had reopened, but they had some emergency.
I believe the problem was a bomb threat somewhere, but they didn't say where. But I thought it was resolved.
Yeah, I thought it happened as well.
Anyway, the Tech Cafe, of course, is a video session. It's not an in-person thing.
Yeah, so it should be open for registration. Okay, thanks all for attending, and we'll see you all next week.
Ciao.